When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Art said we're going to save the best for last, he said, yeah. So I wanted to thank Duncan for coming here this afternoon. I wanted to start off by, I hear this quote now and again, and I've heard it more in the last maybe 10 years, and it was quoted in 1885 by Louis Riel, who was just recognized as our first prime minister our first premier of Manitoba. But the quote goes something like this: our people will sleep for 100 years, and it'll be the artist that'll wake up and give them back their voice or their soul. And I thought about that many times when I heard that, I was trying to, I guess, make sense of it, or I was wondering, well, how will the artist do this? And I think I've learned in the last few years that they'll do it through voice and they'll do it through writing. So I'm really glad that Duncan is here. I've known Duncan for probably 40 some years. We hung around the main drag together, and we never hung out together when we were young. When we knew each other, I always considered him sort of like a nerd kind of a guy, because all the artists hung around together, and we had our group. I was with his brother, and we were the party animals, and these guys were a little bit different from us. But Duncan and I got to know each other in the past maybe 20 years, and we started getting to know each other and start recognizing Duncan's talents. And whenever I'd be asked to organize an event or something like that, I would call upon Duncan to share his knowledge. And when I started hearing Duncan's stories, it reminded me of stories that I heard from my grandparents and my parents. And so I'm really glad that you're able to join us here, Duncan. So I'm going to ask you to start off by a little bit of your own readings and your own history. Thank you for being here.
Well, first of all, we didn't hang out with him for one reason. We had better parties. And they lasted longer. So that's the only reason why. Okay. Thanks for inviting me, Clayton. And I have to apologize for being late. I thought I was going to be in May. So, but apparently I got mixed up with another event. I have to go to May. First of all, I'm a Cree Métis. I'm originally from Missipawistik. My mother was a full-blood Cree from Nelson House, and her dad was from Cross Lake. And my dad was a mixed blood, called Métis now. Mixed blood of a Cree, French, Scottish, and Irish. But we didn't identify with who we were. We identified with our language. We didn't call ourselves an Inuk or Burmese. We called ourselves Cree speakers, because that was our language. That's what our identity was. And my cook was a storyteller at the time, so she spent a lot of time telling stories to us as children. Not so much I think it was just a reminder to who we were. I'll tell you right now, we never considered ourselves as Canadians. We never have. My dad was a Second World veteran. He joined... I say he volunteered And when he was asked who he was, he explained to them that he was Métis, and he was told, well, they don't allow Métis people to join the army because they were still considered non-citizens of this country in the Second World War. So they put him down as French. Well, they needed fighters. And he was a sniper, so when he finally found out in 1950 that he was considered, he was accepted in the Canadian society, he never accepted that. And we never did either. We're still Cree people. That's what we are. We always have been, and we always will be. And so I started writing about that and working in the, where I was working when I was a young man. When I first knew that I was a child without a country, I was surprised that I had been accepted without knowledge. No warning that who I was no longer accepted, that I had been a child without identity. Where I grew as a child, my playground stretched as far as I could run, each path as familiar as the cabin where I played when it was too dark to see where my feet walked. Not realizing that I was a stranger to the place where I lay my head to dream, laugh, or cry. Who gave me the right to sing a song I did not understand. My home and native land did not mean me until given permission to finally say, I am you. What was I before? Only a visitor on the place I first drew breath, recognized, given identity, one that erased who I was before. Why was I displaced? And this piece I'm going to share is the one that I put in a little chapbook I created after the 215 bodies were realized that there was missing babies in the residential schools. When I was born, I was given a name. When I was five, I was given a number. It was to be my new name. When I faded away from where I was, I became a faded memory. When my tears were finally found, I still did not have the name I was born with. The number I became was lost over time. Many cried. I sit here in the shadow with no name, no number. I listen. A statue falls. A man posts. We do not tolerate violence or vandalism. My scars have become dust. My tears have evaporated. I was real once. I had a name. Maybe I should have been a statue. And this one is, I wrote inside the book and all of it. A lot of the stuff I have is just piled up in the box next to me, underneath my computer. But it was a couple of the politicians, but also, of course, the Queen always used that, oh, my Indians. How are my Indians? And a couple of the politicians, especially what I like to call the neocons, always use these words. So I wrote this piece after I heard that, how are my Indians? How is not you Indian? Discovered to be claims like some forgotten piece, godless, soulless, forever wandering across the wilderness. How is not you Indian? The dust I was traveled across a universe, vast stretches of time between suns that settled on a turtle's back. Knowing my path was predetermined, bathed in stardust, born in sacred waters. I is not you, Indian. I is unique. I is not soulless. I is dust, created among the stars, shaped by time and distance. I is not you, Indian. You is not my ally. Anyway, I said it was going to be very, very pretty. What's up?
Wow. This is the first time I've heard these words of myself. And they're very powerful. Like they seem to hit in here. And they were very powerful. And maybe I should have hung around with you instead of Jack, maybe. But I find that many times when we're out there and we're just trying to survive, and I'm not too sure where I got I got my strength was from through culture, from powwow. And I can see where you got your strength was from writing. When did you start finding that voice or that strength? And how old were you when you first started realizing that you could put things on paper?
I guess when I left Grand Rapids, I was 16 years old to go to Cranberry Port to go to high school, even high school in Grand Rapids. And because I was the first time away from home, it was a very lonely time. But we were in a good place. The residential school we went to was a good place, run by the province, wasn't run by the churches, so it was completely different. And but you suddenly realized 95% of the students that were inside that school were indigenous, but they came from all over Manitoba. And so there were different languages that were spoken. There was Ojibwe, Dene, there was Cree, Oji-Cree, all of that was the language that were there. And so it was like being a visitor in a big community and realizing that this was a good place. And I learned, and that's where I learned. And, but because of that loneliness, I started to write. And just to get that loneliness that you had, that the homesickness that you had, because you're in a different place. And you left all your friends behind, the ones that still lived in Grand Rapids. Most of my friends I grew up with ended up in jail or taken by foster parents and all that. So I lost a lot of friends when I was growing up. But realizing that this place was safe, and I felt at home there after a while. But that was one reason. The other reason was there were so many beautiful young women there. There was tons, man. There was lots. So I realized, well, this is a good place. So, and but again, I guess the writing started there. But I stopped when I started working for Highway. I worked in a bush camp from Grand Rapids after I graduated high school, and because I was the only indigenous person working within a group of men. All blue-collar workers, and so you're kind of isolated within that bush camp village, I called it. But you're isolated; you're the only one that's different there. And so that's when I started to write a lot, but I didn't share anything, because most blue-collar workers are very anti-gay, you know. And especially write poetry, right away they identified you as being that kind of person. And didn't matter how hard you worked or who you were fooling around with, to them you were still gay. That was it. So
yeah, so when did you finally feel racism on your journey, when it really kind of hit close to you? When did you first start feeling that?
Once Hydro got to Grand Rapids.
Okay.
It didn't take long. It was our village, but it was taken over. And we were made to feel like we were beneath everybody else. Hydro had this great thing that they had, was they created a hierarchy that was never there before, which was Hydro employees, the construction workers that came there, and then the Métis people were put there, and then treaty people were at the last. So that was the tier system that they created. And that's where we started to realize we were below everybody else, at least in their eyes. In our eyes, we weren't. And so, but it was quite open. It was not hidden racism. It was out in the open. We experienced it all the time. So we learned how to fight.
So that was kind of my next question. I grew up in a home with eight older brothers, and we grew up around army bases, and that's how we survived, was fighting. So how did that change you, I guess, in your writing journey, racism?
Well, I think it was the. It kind of disappeared when I was when I left Grand Rapids. Like I was 16 years old, and I left Grand Rapids, and then my writing started ease off a little bit from that racist part I was experiencing. But it came back again once I started working in the bush camps. Because again, being an indigenous person, you're basically you're trying to prove yourself every time a new band came on the camp. You have to prove yourself over again. I mean, you worked your ass off all those years, and then all of a sudden somebody new comes in, and the first thing they say is, who's the Indian? You know, who's the guy I'm working with? Who's the Indian? That was the first thing they said. You know, how long is he going to be here? You know, I've been here for 3 years already. I don't think I'm leaving, you know, so.
I found that, I think, things kind of really kind of changed for me, I think sort of like around maybe 1989, 1990. And by that time, I was probably in my late 20s already. And but I found that when Oka happened, and I was watching Oka on the news every night and realizing the damage that was done, the history that was done to Indigenous people in Canada by the Canadian government, that really changed me at that time, and it made me want to ask more questions. Whereabouts in that sort of journey did you start changing?
I don't think I ever have.
Okay.
You know, I still have the same ideas. I still have the same beliefs that this country talks a good talk, but they never follow the path that we're supposed to follow. You know. They make a lot of promises. How many promises do you know of that they've completed? Mm-hmm. And so these things have, to me, this country has not changed since I first met Manitoba Hydro. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it's gotten worse in my eyes. And that people argue with me, no, it's changed a lot. Maybe it has, I don't know. But the path I've been on, I have not experienced that change. Maybe because we have a big mouth, I don't know.
1990 was really a really changing year for me. One of our grand chiefs at that time was Phil Fontaine, and Phil was on the front of the Sun paper saying that he was sexually abused at a residential school. That was a real changing point for me. And so he became sort of like a real role model for me. Who was your role model growing up?
My grandmother. What can I say? So it was my grandmother. She was the one that taught me everything. So, okay. I'll tell you right now, I have no use for politicians. Okay. I have absolutely no use for politicians. And whether they're in the parliamentary or the Manitoba politicians or the Indigenous politicians, I really have no use for them. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk to them. You know, we have no choice but talk to them. But I really have no use for them because basically they're, to be politicians are very egotistical people. Mm-hmm. It's for them, it's not for the people. So.
Great, thank you. So your grandmother was your role model. So what kind of changed that, like how did she transfer that to you?
Well, first of all, the gift of storytelling was one that probably the top of the list, but also that you had a task, that you were given a task to do this, and that you had to understand people, and she did that not outright. The way she would talk to us, but it was the way she greeted people when they came to the house to visit. She never closed the door on anybody, no matter what their reputation was. Mm-hmm. You know, she says, it's not for me to judge people. You know, it's not for me to judge people, she says. But I think she also knew what the way I was going to be. She says, I'll tell you that right now. She says, I'll tell you not to judge people. You're probably not going to listen anyway. So. So that was the reason, probably the rare, but I will tell you right now, I I met this man in Grand Rapids when I was, after I moved to Grand Rapids, going back and working in the bush camp. My wife was here in Winnipeg, but I only had weekends off, so I didn't have time to come to Winnipeg. And this young man comes to the house and asks if my brother was home because he was an artist. And so I said, no, he's not here. So he said, well, when's he going to be back? So he should be back soon. He says, you just want to come and wait. So he walked in the house and had him sit down. But I had to go meet my friends. And he says, well, I'll come with you. No, he said, just wait. I said, my mom will be home soon. Just wait, sit here and wait. She'll be home soon. You can talk to her for a while. And then I'll be back later. So I took off. 3 hours later, I'm still at the bar with my friends. And I said, oh, they got someone at the house. So I went back to the house. And he's in there drinking tea with my mom, talking. And we finally introduced ourselves. That was a bad habit, not introducing myself. And he says, my name's Terry. I said, my name is Duncan. It was not till years later I found out his name was Teru. And he became a really good friend of mine. And we talked a lot about the way we were raised, because he was displaced from the West Coast to Calgary in the Second World War. And what we talked about, losing our house in Grand Rapids and moved from where we had to our piece of property to somewhere else in a village. And his experiences working in a dew line by the only Japanese chef there. And me working with Highways Department and the hydro and all that, and being the only indigenous person there. And what we learned growing up, we're growing up as we're working, realizing that we live in a separate country, that we live in a separate country. We live in the same country, but we were treated differently. And we became really good friends. In fact, became such a good friend, he married my cousin. So, well, she was kind of pretty, you know. But the one I want to tell you this, I know it's just about time, I just saw a little sign go up. Yeah. So, when I was working in the southeastern Manitoba, we were talking about your St. Agathe history there, your experiences there. We were working surveys out there, and I ran the instruments, the transit measuring instruments, and the men would all cut the lines, and I'd give them the line where to cut, in a small town in southeastern Manitoba. And this old man drives up on a tractor, comes and asks me what I'm doing. So I said, well, I'm just giving lines, we're going to be measuring this line, we have to go find some survey posts out there. And he goes, who are you looking at? I said, well, there's three guys out there, they're cutting bush, they're going to put up the instruments, I'll measure it, I'll read the angles, and then it'll come out. He's looking. And he says, I can't see anybody. I said, well, I'm looking through the transit, I said. So I still can't see anybody. So finally they start walking out. I said, oh, they're coming out now. And finally they pop up. And he looks at me, looks out the field, looks at me again. And he goes over to my buddy, who's working in the van, taking all these, taking numbers and tossing at him. And all of a sudden my buddy starts laughing. The old man jumps on his tractor and takes off. And my buddy comes over and says, you want to know what the old man said when he was talking to me? I said, no. What did he say? He said, you know, that little Japanese guy can sure see far. So, I guess you're my relative.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com and listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.
Hi. This is Candace Sampson, the voice behind What She Said. My show is your destination for stories that not only entertain, but also educate and empower. Every week, I spotlight strong female voices from across Canada, women who are changing the narrative and driving change. Don't miss out on these inspiring episodes. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music, or head over to whatshesaidtalk.com.
What She Said can also be heard on blasttheradio.com, Mondays at 5 p.m. and Wednesdays at 7 p.m. That's blasttheradio.com.
It's time to dive into the stories that truly matter.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.